One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you guests from our 2020 webinar series. The Honourable Matt Keane is the New South Wales Minister for Energy and the Environment, and he officially launched the 2020 Climate of the Nation Report for the Australia Institute last year. He was joined in conversation by the Australia Institute's Executive Director, Ben Oakquist, and Director of our Climate and Energy Program, Richie Merzian. And this webinar was hosted by Noah Schultz-Byard, SA Director at the Australia Institute. Climate of the Nation is the country's longest running survey of community attitudes towards climate change, and this year it found record high levels of concern about climate change, even mid-pandemic, that 7 in 10 Australians think state governments should be taking a leading role in action on climate change, and that most people, unsurprisingly, would prefer a renewable-led recovery to a gas-fueled one.
We need to tackle both the corona pandemic, this crisis, at the same time as we tackle the climate and environmental emergency.
Once the COVID-19 threat passes, the question is now being asked whether the world's economies will be looking to the fossil fuel industry to lead the recovery.
We have never had the opportunity to move so much money at once. But if we don't do it in a way that we serve the climate at the same time, it's going to be even more difficult to achieve the Paris goals.
One of the best ways of bouncing back after the corona crisis would be to boost renewable energy spending in Australia.
And the government's doing everything it can to ensure that as we come out of this, we have a recovery which is making the most of those lower energy prices.
We are going to stand by our tradies and we are going to save their youth.
I firmly believe the action on climate change can actually reduce emissions, but also create jobs and reduce power prices.
That this state is going to take its place with the leaders of the world in taking our planet toward a more prosperous and cleaner future. A future where our kids have greater opportunities than any generation that has come before them. And a future we here are privileged to be helping to shape. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
This was recorded live on October the 28th, 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Noah Schultz-Byard, the SA Director at the Australia Institute. I'm filling in for Ebony Bennett, the Australia Institute's Deputy Director and the usual host of our webinar series. But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that I'm coming to you today from the land of the Kaurna people on the beautiful Adelaide Plains and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet. Sovereignty was never ceded, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. We've got a great session for you today. We'll hear first from Minister Keane, and then Richie will join him in conversation, asking about issues that were raised in the huge number of questions that were submitted by members of the audience before the session today. Unfortunately, as is often the case, we won't be able to get to all of the questions that have been submitted, but we will discuss the themes that were most consistently raised in them. The minister will then need to depart, but Richie will still be with us, and he'll take us through some slides and some key results from the report, and then take some more of your questions. First, though, to introduce our guest, I'll hand over to Executive Director of the Australia Institute, Ben Oakquist.
Thanks, Nara, and thanks to all of you who have registered. Over 1,300 people have registered for this webinar. Nara was just telling the Minister and I and Richie before we came on air. So welcome to all of you, as Noah said. Thanks for the introduction, Noah. I'm going to leave you to a conversation with our Climate and Energy Director, Richie Merzian, and the Minister in a moment. My job is simply to introduce and thank the Minister for coming. As many of you know, the Climate of the Nation report we're releasing today is Australia's longest running continuous survey on Australians' attitudes to climate change. The Australia Institute has been fortunate to inherit this landmark project, originally the purview of the Climate Institute. Thank you to the many of you who are listening to this webinar who have supported this project and indeed the Climate and Energy Program itself that makes all this work possible. We can't do any of it without such support. And I know that support comes in donations, large and small. Thank you for making a difference. This report is having a big impact on the climate debate. And I think it's particularly important that this 2020 report has come out now. Unfortunately, there was an election narrative out of 2019 by some that suggested that strong action on climate change was a vote loser. I really think this benchmark report resets that narrative in 2020. We're very fortunate to have Minister Matt Keane here to launch the report today. Minister Keane is the New South Wales Minister for Energy and the Environment, very well known to many of you. Elected, I'm told, as a member for Hornsby in 2011 at the age of 29. I certainly can't remember what I was doing at 29. Well done for getting in there so early, Minister. The Minister is a strong advocate for a science and economics-led approach to climate change. Mr. Keane was amongst the first Conservative politicians to call out the link between climate change and this summer's unprecedented bushfire season. So a nice marriage that he's launching this report today on the day that the Bushfire Royal Commission is handed to government. He sees reducing our emissions as not only necessary to protect our environment, but key to our future prosperity. Minister Keane believes it's time for the centre of Australian politics to find its voice again. Welcome, Minister Keane. Over to you.
Ben, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and good morning to everyone who's tuning in. Can I begin too by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're gathered and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and also remind everyone that the land we're meeting on is, was and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm so incredibly glad to be here to launch the Climate of the Nation Report 2020. And I thank the Australia Institute for making sure the voices of everyday Australians are heard, particularly on this issue. Now more than ever, we are in need of an evidence-based policy and thought leadership approach. The Australia Institute continues to lead the way on both fronts, playing a vital role in building a stronger, fairer, and more sustainable nation. I also want to thank the many Australians who gave their time to participate in this important piece of research. They are representative of the Australians I was elected to serve. Generous, hardworking, and caring people who love their country. People who choked on smoke from the summer's bushfires and worried about the future. People desperate to see our economy recover, but want to ensure that we build back better and stronger. They are the forgotten people. They are mums and dads in the suburbs. They are business owners installing solar panels to cut their electricity bill. They're tradies who see an abundance of work in building and maintaining renewable assets. They are from all professions and all walks of life. They don't hold elected office. They don't march down George Street. They don't have a platform on Sky News. They are ordinary, decent Australians who just want to go about their business and for their governments to get on with solving the issues of the day. They are the mainstream, and their voices need to be heard when decisions are made about the energy they use and the world they'll leave their children. The findings of the Climate of the Nation Report 2020 should put an end to the pointless, backward-looking arguments about taking action on climate change. 80% of Australians think that we are already experiencing the impact of climate change. And they are right. 82% of Australians are concerned that climate change will result in more bushfires, exactly the sort of events that scientists have been warning us about for decades. 83% of Australians support an orderly transition from coal-fired power stations to renewables. And 71% of Australians can see past the noise generated by the powerful and the populists to see that Australia can and should become a world leader in finding solutions to climate change. They don't want Australia to be spectators in the greatest technological transformation of our time. They want us to lead. Australians are, in my experience, hard-headed, pragmatic people. They know the rest of the world is moving on climate change. Today, more than half the world's GDP is created in jurisdictions that have signed up to deliver net zero emissions by 2050. Together with Japan's announcement this week, 60% of Australia's two-way trade is now with countries who will soon be looking for cleaner alternatives to power their economies. Ignoring the reality of climate change is not just a risk to our natural environment, which it is. It's a risk to our living standards, to our jobs, and to our entire way of life. If that evidence is not enough to convince you on the need to take action, then even big oil and gas companies who have profited from extracting fossil fuels for decades are planning for life beyond carbon, moving to decarbonize their businesses. In February this year, that organization, not known for its green left credentials, BP, announced its target of net zero emissions by 2050. It launched a plan to build 50 gigawatts of renewables by 2030. That's renewable investment in infrastructure and on an unprecedented scale. And that's not happening in the far distant future. It's happening right now. They're not doing this because they're climate alarmists. They're doing it because they're capitalists and want to ensure that they remain a going concern as the world changes. As this report shows, Australians see the change. We understand it. We want to make sure that we reap the opportunities created for new jobs and investment. And we don't want to find ourselves on the wrong side of mega trends like rising carbon-based protectionism, while other economies steal our march in new clean technologies and industries. The quantitative survey for this report was conducted in July, and the qualitative research in September, smack bang in the middle of our fight to contain the coronavirus pandemic. This should be a final rebuke to the cynical view that concern about climate change was a good times issue, which people would drop when the times got tough, because these are amongst the toughest times our country and our people have ever faced. COVID-19 has upended financial markets, stalled investment, increased unemployment, and driven some sectors of the economy close to the brink. We should be using this recovery to build a low-carbon economy. We should be using this recovery to drive a sustainable stimulus. And we should be using this recovery to build our country back better. Not just because it's good for our environment, but because it's good for the state, the country, and it's the kind of economy our kids are going to be able to prosper from. Australians are sick and tired of the petty political point scoring and division on climate policy, which has held our country back for over a decade. They want government to lead. They want to be assured that we are doing everything we can to reduce the risk of dangerous climate change whilst keeping the lights on and keeping a lid on their electricity bills. They want us working on solutions to create jobs and ensure no community is left behind. This report is a wake-up call from Australia to remind all of us that they want their governments to get on with the job of protecting the environment and building a better future for all of us to enjoy.
Thank you very much, Minister. A wake-up call of a speech to introduce Climate of the Nation 2020. Much appreciated. And I particularly enjoyed your reference to the forgotten people. And this is a report about letting the community's voice speak loudly, and we hope it does something for the debate. I'm going to hand over now to Noah and Richie to get into a bit of a Q&A.
Richie, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, thanks, Noah, and thank you, Minister, for those opening comments. You mentioned we did a quantitative research, which is building on the Climate of the Nation's 13-year history in taking those attitudinal views. But then we also added qualitative research this time around with the help of the Australian Museum, both in Sydney and also in Brisbane. And from those views, as well as some of the pre-submitted questions, we've just come up with a few that we'd like to pose to you now. Kicking off with, I think, where you left off, which is what is happening right now. The report shows that now one in two Australians believe that climate change is increasing the number of bushfires right now. That number has almost doubled since 2018. Following the devastating Black Summer bushfires, you're on the forefront of highlighting the link between climate change and the fires and calling for efforts to reduce our national emissions. What are your reflections on the Black Summer bushfires, and why did you feel the need to speak out about climate change?
Well, Richie, at the time I thought I made a relatively unremarkable observation. The smoke that we were choking on for weeks, the drought that had been going on for years, the hotter, drier summer that we were seeing was not normal. And I didn't expect everyone to lose their minds over that comment, because the reality is that what we saw last summer was exactly what the scientists had warned us about. Climate change would create the very conditions that would allow catastrophic bushfires to occur on an unprecedented scale. Now, my view is that we need to listen to the scientists. We need to listen to the experts. We need to act on their advice. I mean, this sounds like a relatively uncontroversial idea, but when it comes to climate change, apparently it is. It's a strategy that served us well during the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the right approach to take when dealing with this issue as well. No one wants to see bushfires like we saw last summer. We know what we need to do as part of a global effort to reduce the impact of climate change. And my view is, rather than sit back and watch like the overwhelming view of the people in the Climate of the Nation survey, Australia should lead the way. Yes, there are threats to our environment. Yes, there are threats to our economy as a result of global warming. But what's not often talked about is the enormous opportunities by getting ahead of the curve and making sure that we can help other countries solve these problems. As I said in my speech, 50% of the world's GDP has now signed up to hit net zero emissions. Many of them don't have the pathway to get there. We can provide that pathway thanks to the entrepreneurial, innovative spirit of Australians. We can develop the technologies that will help economies around the globe decarbonize through the work of our businesses and our universities and our lived experience right here in Australia. And in doing so, we can gain a competitive advantage in a low-carbon global economy, creating jobs, industries, and indeed growing our living standards. We need to do that, though, in a way that leaves no one behind. And that's the big challenge. And we've been stuck in this debate for over a decade because we haven't found that pathway forward to ensuring that no one's left behind. That's exactly what I'm trying to do at the moment as the Minister for Energy, Environment in New South Wales. And I'll work with any jurisdiction, any think tank that wants to join us in helping ensure that we create new jobs, drive investment into our economy, grow our living standard, increase our living standards and prosperity, and set Australia up to be an energy and economic superpower in a low-carbon global economy.
Mm. Well, Minister, we're delighted that you are working with us on this particular report. And that comes down to the question of the role of different jurisdictions. So the report found that 7 out of 10 Australians believe state governments in Australia should actually lead on climate action, regardless of what others do. Is that how you see the role of state governments and your government in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a global race underway. I was recently in Germany last year whilst we could still travel. I was speaking at an international energy conference, Spruiking the Virtues of Investing in New South Wales. Following my speech was the Minister for Energy in Morocco, who told people, don't bother with Australia, as they, even though they've got an abundance of cheap renewable energy, the difference, he said to the audience, was that they had a government that believed in climate change, in reducing their emissions. The reality is that international markets are moving, demanding cheaper, cleaner forms of reliable energy. And to those people on this call that don't believe we should be taking action, don't believe that climate change is happening, well, you don't need to believe in climate change to believe in capitalism. And the reality is the markets that have underwritten our prosperity through trade for generations are changing the products that they're demanding. And we are well-placed as any country on the planet to provide those goods and services that those markets are demanding. And we should do it. So we can either grab the opportunities that are emerging, creating those new jobs that I talked about, industries and economic growth, or be left behind, turn New South Wales and indeed Australia into a rust bucket state by denying the international reality. We know that in New South Wales we need to modernise our electricity system. In the next 15 years, 4 of our 5 existing generators are going to come to the end of their technical lives. With nothing to do with climate change, they're just old pieces of equipment. That infrastructure needs to be replaced, and by replacing it with cheap, clean, reliable energy, we give ourselves that competitive advantage. Cheap energy in a low-cost global economy will see new industries look to domicile here, creating new jobs. There are so many opportunities that are emerging, and I'm just suggesting that rather than shutting down existing industries, we grab the opportunities that new ones are presenting. Creating jobs for New South Wales, driving investment into the state and underwriting our prosperity for future generations. I mean, what have we got to lose?
I think you're speaking to the converted here on those lines, Minister. And on the cheap, reliable, clean energy that you're talking about, a little bit over 3/4 of those surveyed in the report believe that state governments should be offering more incentives to actually bring on more renewables onto our electricity grid. You've announced 2 ambitious renewable energy zones for New South Wales, but at the same time, the state is playing catch up with the lower end of renewable penetration when it comes to the different states on the electricity grid. Is that enough to bring on board that transition, given it is economically competitive now?
Look, I, Richie, have a hypothesis that people don't really care how they get their electrons. They just need them to be there when they want to turn the lights on or watch TV or, you know, warm their house or cool their house, and they want them to be as cheap as possible. So my focus is on exactly that, making sure people in New South Wales get access to the cheapest form of reliable energy. And today, that's not gas and it's not coal and it's not nuclear. Maybe nuclear in the future if technology comes down the cost curve. And
sure, in 100 or 200 years, sure.
Sure, like no one's ruling that out. Today, the cheapest combination, the cheapest way to deliver electricity into the system is a combination of wind, solar, storage, and also demand response. Storage like pumped hydro, for example. That's not me saying that. That's the engineers, the scientists, and the economists at the CSIRO and AEMO, the independent market operator. I think we should be listening to the people well qualified to give this advice. I think we should be taking ideology out of the discussion and focusing on evidence and science. We know, as I said, that in the next 15 years, 4 of our existing sources of generation need to be replaced. Now, the government took 30 years to build the current system, and we need to replace that working with the private sector in less than 15. So we're running out of tarmac. We need to get the new generation installed before the old generation closes to avoid price spikes and blackouts like we saw after the closure of Hazelwood. And we know these new forms of generation, whether it be renewable energy zones, pumped hydro, battery storage, transmission lines, is going to take time to construct. But we also know that the current price signals and regulatory environment is no longer fit for purpose. So we need reform if we're going to deliver on that promise of cheaper, reliable energy. We need reform if we're going to make sure that the private sector can do in 15 years what it took the government in New South Wales over 30 years to do. And we need to make sure that we get those price signals and that regulatory environment we need to deliver that infrastructure on time and on budget. And that's exactly what I intend to do.
Minister, you mentioned demand response, which something that the Australian Institute has been pushing for a number of years, along with colleagues at the Total Environment Centre and PIAC, which is basically to incentivize people to reduce their electricity if possible, as a way of reducing demand rather than just always trying to increase supply. A rule change has been brought in, so it will be coming online next year as well. But demand response is just part of that picture. As you said, that regulatory reform, we're still seeing delays in some of the transmission work that needs to happen. There's a big project to redesign the national electricity market for 2025 that the Energy Security Board is taking on. What do we need to do to expedite this transition to build an electricity sector that caters for the modern electricity mix that we all want?
Well, you know, the way we get our energy, or the cheapest way of getting reliable energy, is no longer getting big central generators and throwing transmission lines up to get the electrons to market. We know the cheapest way to deliver electricity that's reliable is going to be a suite of measures: a bit of wind, a bit of solar, a bit of pumped hydro. We'll see batteries come down the cost curve. We're going to need to build new transmission. But we also know that, you know, managing our demand, making sure that we're using electricity at the time when, at the times of the day when it's abundant and cheap, is going to benefit consumers and help stabilize the grid. I mean, we're already seeing in South Australia at the moment times of the day where you're getting negative electricity prices. So businesses and consumers are getting paid to take electricity out of the system. So we need to make sure that we're developing the technology and rolling that out across the state to help people benefit from that really cheap, abundant electricity. It'll see huge benefits to consumers, as I said, but it will also see huge system benefits, managing the stability of the grid. That's, again, why we need the right market settings to encourage demand response mechanisms and the right incentives to ensure that we get some of the cheapest energy in the world. Right now, that regulatory environment, those market signals, they're built for an old world order. We need to get on with making sure that it's fit for purpose for the modern system if we're going to make sure that people get cheap, reliable energy. That's what my focus is. And the problem is that government is not keeping up with the changes in technology. That's because changes in technology are increasing at an exponential rate. It's really fast. But it's also because of the political inertia. We've let politics and ideology getting in the way of those market forces. I think we should be getting out of the way. I'm not just arguing my case as someone that cares about our environment. I'm arguing it because I'm an economically rational liberal. I can't think of anything that is more in line with what the Liberal Party should be about than supporting the free market to deliver the outcomes that are best for consumers. And I think I'm acting completely in line with the values of my party. And that's why it's about time someone spoke up for it.
Well, we appreciate you speaking up on it right here on this webinar, Minister. It's one thing our report shows, which is very similar to what you were saying, is that there's a majority support across different voting intentions, be it Coalition or Labor or the Greens or some of the minor parties, for a national net zero target. New South Wales has a state level net zero target as well. We hear overnight that the Prime Minister had a call with Boris Johnson around the UK's leadership on climate, including pressing Australia for a more ambitious target, including that long-term net zero by 2050 target. So what can we do to, or what lessons do you think Australia should draw on from other conservative politicians or even conservative governments like the UK to help bring this about?
Look, 31 years ago, in Washington, D.C., there was a scientist from NASA called James Hansen, and he testified before the Senate committee. He advised that congressional hearing that increasing levels of greenhouse gases were driving sustained warming of the global planet 31 years ago. Now, reporting of Hansen's testimony made the front page of the New York Times the next day. And 2 months after that testimony, the then Republican presidential candidate, George Bush Sr., said, "Those who think we are powerless to do anything about the greenhouse gas effect, forget about the White House effect. And as president, I intend to do something about it." So this wasn't some far-left Bernie Sanders Democrat. This was George Bush, the establishment of the Republican Party. You know, world leaders of all colours took the scientific advice seriously. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher backed up action to reduce emissions. In 1992, President Bush signed the first global agreement to address climate change. My point is, Richie, is that climate change didn't start out as a political issue. We made it one. And this needs to end. There can be plenty of debate about how best to reduce our emissions, but there should be no debate about the fact that we need to do so. And climate change should not be a partisan issue. It's not in the UK, as you cited. It's not across Europe, and it's not in places like Japan. In fact, largely, those jurisdictions are run by conservative governments and they're leading the way on this issue. What could be more conservative than protecting and handing our environment to the next generation better than we found it? What could be more important to centre-right governments than growing the economy, creating jobs and increasing our prosperity? I mean, this has traditionally been an article of faith for the right of the body politic. So as I said before, rather than being at odds with the values of the centre-right, I'm absolutely in line with them. And it's about time someone stood up for the centre of Australian politics in this debate. Centre stood up for what I termed as the forgotten people, and I chose that term deliberately. These are not the people that are represented by big business or big unions. They're not the people that have access to Sky After Dark or newspaper ownership. They're the mums and dads in the suburbs. They just want to get on with their lives. They want to be able to, you know, put food on the table. They're focused on driving their kids to and from sport, making sure they get a great education. And you know what they want from government? Not a lot. Not a lot. They want government to get on with solving the big challenges so that they can enjoy their lives the way they choose to do so and make sure that they get the opportunities and give their kids the opportunities that they want for them. It's not a big ask. This is a huge issue. It's a huge issue that goes to the heart of the type of environment we're going to give to our kids. But even more importantly, or equally importantly, it's a huge issue that goes to the heart of the type of future, the type of jobs, the type of prosperity that we're going to hand over to our kids. So, you know, there's too much at stake to get this wrong. We need to act now. We know the world is moving. By 2030, as I said, I mean, 60% of our trading partners have already signed up to hit net zero emissions. So, you know, the products that they're going to demand for us are going to shift. And if Biden wins the White House next week, and there's a good chance, if you look at the polling, that that is going to occur, that means 70% of our trading partners our global trade will be with countries that are determined to hit net zero emissions by 2050. So there is so much at stake here. And as I said, there can be plenty of debate about the best way to reduce our emissions. But in my view, there should be no debate about the fact we need to do it.
It's well put. 2 weeks ago, we had a former Republican Congressman, Bob Inglis, on our webinar, who talked about how, you know, he wanted to see far more climate action in the US, but found it difficult to connect with his colleagues on this issue. I mean, the messages you're giving us here seem incredibly sensible, and seem to come from a place that aligns with how you've seen your politics. But how have these conversations gone for you within your party, talking to your colleagues in the coalition? And for those on the call now who are under electorates that do have coalition politicians, what can they do to communicate similar messages or effective messages on climate change?
Look, I mean, I, as I said, I'm not arguing this just because I care about our environment, which I do. I'm arguing this because I'm a capitalist. I'm arguing this because I believe in the free market. I'm arguing this because I want to see great, high-paying jobs in New South Wales. I'm arguing this because I want to see investment and infrastructure built in this state. I'm arguing this because I want to see energy-intensive industries choosing to domicile here in New South Wales and not in other jurisdictions overseas. I'm arguing this because I want to see the cheapest electricity anywhere on the planet right here in this state. You know, that's great for families. It's great for businesses. I'm arguing these things because I'm economically rational. I'm not some guy that goes out protesting in the streets. I'm not, trying to dismantle the capitalist system. I'm trying to enhance it and grow it. So that's where I'm arguing this case from in my party and to, you know, those mainstream Australians that care about this issue. I think that the success, the road to success here is explaining how it's going to, action on climate change can be done in a way that grows our economy, grows our living standards and leaves no one behind. The key thing that's been holding back action in this space is the abyss between the fear of action and the future terror of inaction. And we cannot be caught in this, I guess, purgatory any longer. There's too much at stake. So let's take action on climate change in a way that not only protects our environment, but grows our economy, creates jobs, and leaves no one behind. That's what I'm focused on. And I'll work with anyone. I don't care what their political colour is. I don't care what their agenda is. As long as they want to make Australia an even stronger, more prosperous and better nation, then let's work together. These things are beyond politics. Let's get it done. I'm happy to debate Labor and the Greens about the best way to get that done, but there should be no debate that we need to get it done.
Changing lanes right now to the transport sector minister. I think you're one of the few, maybe even the only minister that drives an electric vehicle as their government car. But electric vehicles in Australia are in a really dire space. Only, 0.6% of new car sales are electric. And you compare that to somewhere like Norway, where in September, 8 out of 10 new cars sold were electric. A lot of that has been driven by policy, like smart policies to incentivize the cars we want and disincentivize those that we don't. What can we do in Australia to actually increase electric vehicle uptake? And what are you looking to do in New South Wales?
Richie, well, just back to your point about having an electric car. I think I was the first minister anywhere in the country to get an EV. And I got it because my previous vehicle was a Toyota Kluger. And I just wanted to go and see whether we could get an electric vehicle that was cheaper than my previous one. And we were able to find that. So we got this because it was cheaper up front. It's cheaper over the life of the lease. And guess what? It's much more fun to drive. 0 to 100 in 3.8 seconds, so I'm told. So I'm told, not that I know. And EVs will keep coming down the cost curve. In fact, it's another area where the world is moving really fast. Think of Tesla. That was once a pie-in-the-sky plan, is now the most valuable car company in the world. Think of Volkswagen. They're changing their entire production lines to electric vehicles to be net zero across their entire supply chain by 2050. So they're going to start moving in that direction at an exponential rate if they're going to hit that target. And it's not just happening to the top end of the market. You know, Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen, Tesla. It's also happening to the middle part of the market. So Honda just recently announced that they too would be net zero across their supply chain by 2050, and they'll be starting to phase out all petrol and diesel vehicles by 2022. You know, Honda, not known for being green radical climate alarmists. They're capitalists. They're doing this because they see that they can deliver a better product at a cheaper price to consumers. So why wouldn't they move in that direction? And these international trends, again, are going to impact the choice and the costs of vehicles that Australians will get. I mean, we don't have a car manufacturing industry here in Australia. So we're going to have to take those products that are coming from overseas, and those products that will be delivered here will change. But we will also, as EVs grow in scale, it'll mean Australians will get more choice, and they'll also get improvements in the technology, like longer range that these vehicles can go, and at the same time driving down costs. So I think New South Wales government has an important role to play. In fact, governments in Australia have an important role to play to drive the uptake of EVs. Here in New South Wales, we see that by increasing the government fleet target and we've done it, we've increased it to 30% of EVs, and including 10% that will be pure electric. So government's a huge buyer of cars, so this is one way that will bring more cars into the market. And that'll catalyse the second-hand market, so people will be able to get enter the EV market at a lower cost. But we're also working on a big program to roll out fast charging stations across the state. I mean, range anxiety, as we saw at the last election, is definitely a problem that we have here in Australia. So we need to give potential EV drivers confidence that they'll be able to charge when and where they need it. So one of the most exciting movements in this space is our plan to roll out electric buses here in New South Wales. Mm. Electric buses are not only great ways to reduce pollution, so the smog around our cities, but they're quieter and cheaper to run. So change is coming in this space, and government needs to act to ensure that the economy is ready when it happens. Again, the cars that will come into the New South Wales and indeed Australian market will be coming from overseas. A lot of those manufacturers are phasing out combustion engines and moving towards EVs and other forms of technology. We've seen Daihatsu recently say that they'll be moving into hydrogen vehicles. That'll catalyse the development of a huge hydrogen market, for example, again, creating jobs and massive opportunities for Australia. So government has an important role to play to facilitate that orderly transition to EVs, not just because it's going to be good for consumers, but also it's going to be an important part of managing the stability of our grid. We want batteries or EVs taking electricity out of the system in the middle of the day when people are at work, they can charge it up, help stabilise the grid, and also deliver bill savings because they won't be paying petrol once a week.
Yep, and have much lower maintenance costs as well because they don't have an engine with a million parts in it. Mm. As you said, Minister, to use the current phraseology, Australia is a car taker now, not a car maker. How do we smooth that road? I'm conscious of the time, and I know that you have a number of pressing things to get to, Minister. So I might hand it over to Noah to sign you out.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Thank you, first of all, for the speech and your comments there, but also for being able to take all of those questions from Richie, which were informed by the report and the questions that were pre-submitted before the webinar. It was very eloquently put and well spoken. I think the one question that was sort of coming through in the chat more than any other while I was having a look was, in a positive way, when are we going to see you in Canberra? And some of your leadership on this issue was appreciated, I feel, from those questions. So perhaps a final word, Minister, and then we understand you have to move on, and I'll take up the conversation after that.
Noah, Ben and Richie, thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to participate in this discussion. Can I thank everyone for taking the time to tune in, whether you agree with my worldview or you don't. I think it's really important that we continue to have this debate about how we make our country more prosperous, create more jobs and drive more investment here. There is so much at stake for the type of planet and environment we'll hand our kids, but also the type of economy that we're going to hand them, the type of jobs that they'll inherit, the type of living standards that they'll enjoy. Every generation has had to fight for social progress. You know, our grandparents' generation came back from the war and built, after fighting against fascism and totalitarianism, they came back and built an egalitarian society. You know, our parents' generation went through, a revolution to ensure that people could have more choices in their personal lives. Our generation needs to take up the fight to ensure that we do deliver a better environment and a stronger economy. And this issue, solving this issue in a way that achieves that, is going to be key. So I don't care what your politics are. I don't care what your worldview is. We can all agree that we want to make Australia even better. And I'm keen to work with all of you who want to achieve that objective.
Great. Well,
thank you, Minister. Thank really you. Appreciate it. Evidence, science, economics, a great clarion call for all of us. And we have a little saying here at the Australia Institute that we believe in politics. And despite it having a bad rap and being a dirty word for some, we know it's important in making change. And you want to believe in politics, what greater inspiration than a politician like you, one who believes in working across the aisle with all sides, a motto here at the Australia Institute too, and not just for your leadership on climate change, but indeed helping make democracy work in an age where it's getting a bad rap and in trouble. So we're really pleased that you're able to spend the time with us today, and grateful for all your work for climate change and indeed the political debate and democracy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Great. Well, thank you for that. We will carry on with the webinar. The Minister will leave us now, but we still have a little bit of time left. Just wanted to say, while Richie is hopefully able to bring up some slides from the report, we've been joined today by more than 700 people that have tuned in from across the country. I've seen in the comments there are people from the NT over to New South Wales, some people down here in South Australia, and people over in Western Australia are coming in from all corners of the land. So thank you for being with us. We have a little bit more time, potentially, if our technology is working.
Noah, I think you might just have to enable slide sharing for panellists.
I see. All panellists. Has that fixed it for you there, Richie?
Yes, it seems to.
Great.
And hopefully that is coming up now.
Yes, that's come up. Great. Thank you, Richie. Feel free to take it away.
Just waiting for the actual visual to load. But yeah, so as Noah mentioned, today we launched Climate of the Nation 2020. This is the 13th year. The report began with the Climate Institute in 2007, and when they closed up shop, we were fortunate enough to inherit this project and continue. And I'm just presenting a few key results here today because we want this to be a resource, this benchmark report, for those who want to talk climate change, who want to take these discussions forward to actually draw on it. Following the Black Summer bushfires, different estimates for how much that cost, but it is in the range of $100 billion, the impacts from that bushfire, which are linked to climate change. And so the question remains, who will pay for the increasing disaster bill from these climate impacts? We asked the almost 2,000 Australians who responded, and two-thirds, 65%, support a levy placed on fossil fuel exports. So Australia is the largest exporter of coal and the largest exporter of liquefied natural gas. Collectively, Australia is the third largest exporter of fossil fuels in the world after Russia and Saudi Arabia. Of all the fossil fuels that we dig up in Australia, three-quarters go overseas. So by applying a small levy of a dollar per embedded ton of emissions in the coal or gas, you can raise upwards of $1.5 billion, and then more depending on how you structure the levy. That has strong support across the community, only 21% oppose. So when we are having discussions around how we pay for climate impacts, it's worth noting that the majority of Australians want fossil fuel exporters, fossil fuel companies, to actually help pay for that bill, because right now it's free to pollute in Australia. This was touched upon by the minister. Every state and territory has a goal of net zero emissions by 2050. What that basically means is that we will not have any more coal-fired power, we shouldn't have any more gas-fired power, and we shouldn't be really relying on internal combustion engine vehicles or high-polluting industries come 2050. That's basically what it means, and there's over two-thirds of Australians who want to see that target elevated, so it's not just for the states and territories, it's for the country as well. And this was also part of the conversation Boris Johnson had last night. This will come up over and over again because Japan has taken on this target, Korea has this target, China has a target that's 2060, but the US, Joe Biden, does also have a net zero by 2050 target. So Australia could come under increasing pressure, and it is a popular choice to move down this path as well. As you can see, only 13% disagree. This was a particularly interesting one. It's the first time we asked this question. Gas, fossil gas, what we use to some of us to heat our homes or to cook or to heat up our water, fossil gas has become a national issue.
Richie, sorry, mate. I might jump in there. We're just having a little bit of trouble with the screen share. It seems to be on the original slide. I'm not sure if there's a way that that can be changed.
Can you?
There we go.
Sorry, let's see.
No worries. And it's not full screen, but we can now see where we're up to, slide 2 of 5.
All right. Let's try again. What I'll do is, yep. All right. That sounds good. Let's go with this. If that's coming through all right, or is it a bit too small?
I think we can see that there, slide 3 of 5. Yeah.
Yep. So this one was just the net zero. It basically shows 68% of Australians support a national target of net zero emissions by 2050, 13% don't. The slide I had before just showed similarly that 2/3 of Australians support a levy on fossil fuel exports and only 21% oppose. The slide I was just talking about, which is really one of the more interesting findings, and it's the first time we asked this question. We asked Australians, how many people do you think actually work in the gas industry in Australia? The actual number is 0.2% of Australia's total workforce. The result was that people thought it was more like 8.2%. To put that in actual numbers, there's about 28,000 that work in the oil and gas industry, and Australians think it's over 1 million. So wrong by a factor of 40. And it was similarly bad for how much income the Commonwealth government makes off the gas industry, getting it wrong by a factor of 45. They only make about $1 billion from the petroleum resources rent tax, but Australians think it's more in the realm of 50 billion. So there's this oversized perception of the employment and the income that Australia gets from the gas industry, and it is in the same ballpark when it comes to the coal industry. And this is why it's difficult to have these conversations around the cost of action when we have this inflated sense of what we're losing if we do transition. And I'll leave it there, and we can have a little bit of room for any questions, Noah.
Yes, thank you, Richie. We are, of course, running over time with such a rich amount of content to talk through, but I did want to use this opportunity to ask a few of the questions that have come in over the course of the webinar itself. Richie, one question here from Chris Sanderson. They've asked, how feasible politically would it be for the states to get together and agree to meet the Paris targets? And potentially, I think we could expand on that. How effective would the states working as a coalition be compared to a situation where if the federal government is refusing to act, can the states work together to overcome that inertia?
It's an interesting question because it's not a theoretical one. The situation happened when John Howard was the prime minister, and you had a number of state governments band together and come up with a plan for a emissions trading scheme just between the states. It's worth remembering that the New South Wales government was the first jurisdiction, I think, in the world to come up with a carbon price mechanism, which was called GGAS at the time. So it was the Global Greenhouse Gas Abatement Scheme, I believe. So it has happened before. It can be effective. It's almost the threat of states moving ahead without the federal government that can be as effective as the actual implementation. But having said that, states are in charge of electricity. That's 1/3 of our emissions. States have a major role on transport. That's 20% of our emissions. They have a major role when it comes to industrial pollution. That's another 20%. So if you look at the pie of our emissions and how it's split up, a lot of that can come under states. And so states can band together and come up with great ways of resolving it. And the renewable energy targets right now in Victoria, in Queensland, South Australia moving towards 100%, Tasmania potentially 200%. These are doing great things for reducing our electricity. In fact, I'd say that it's state action right now that is actually reducing emissions, not federal action. So it can be quite powerful. But if we really want to change things, then we also need to get the federal government on board. And if we're talking specifically about the Paris Agreement target, that is being met right now by the federal government by using these leftover Kyoto credits. Now, you know, like there's a number of analogies, but it's basically Australia got it off easy under the previous climate agreement when it accrued these credits for doing very little work. And now it wants to use this extra credit to avoid reducing emissions over the next 10 years. much like earning a whole bunch of gold stars when you're in kindergarten for your finger stars, when you're in kindergarten for your finger painting, and then wanting to use that for your HSC mark. It doesn't really stack up. And so if we want the federal government, if we want the country to go down the path of taking serious emission reductions, we will need the federal government to come on board. But right now there is pressure from the ground up, and that should increase. And as we're seeing, there's increasing pressure internationally, including from key trading partners and allies, to actually do more as well.
Great segment there about state and federal. Ben, I might bring you in here. One of the other themes that's been coming through in the questions is, alongside state and federal divide, we have the political divide. We do a lot of polling at the Australia Institute that asks people across the political spectrum how they feel, but I think it's a little bit difficult with a conservative government to break through on climate issues. What is it about the conversation in Australia that you think has made it political, and how can we attempt to break through that?
Well, I think the conversation with Matt Keane was so interesting today. There are so many reasons to want strong action on climate change. And I think he was a very forceful advocate for climate action from the centre or the centre-right, if you like, and being willing to work with people, whatever their reasons are for addressing climate change or the technologies or the solutions that will enable it, is really important. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to be willing to work with people, whatever their motives are. Sometimes it's easy to think that unless somebody is driven by the same motivation as you to solve the climate change problem, or isn't as passionate as you, or doesn't believe in exactly the same rationale for taking action, that you can't work with them. And I thought Minister Keane's observations about the forgotten people were very profound, and essentially linking an Australia Institute report with Menzies' forgotten people, or Menzies' modern forgotten people, said something important, that there is a big chunk of Australia out there that isn't being spoken to on climate change issues, that some of the centre-right or right commentariat thinks that they own a large chunk of regional Australia or suburban Australia. And what Minister Keane was basically saying is it's just not true, that the forgotten Australians aren't finding a political voice are often not finding a political voice for action on climate change. And a willingness of people to work across the aisle, which was really Minister Keane's plea today, by his willingness to do something, is a lesson for everybody to take on board who wants to see climate change taken seriously and to meet the challenge. Because we only have this 8 to 10 year window probably now to address it globally. Otherwise, we are going to have runaway climate change. And that means working quickly with people from all sides. As Keane said, he's very willing to have that debate with anybody about what is the best way of getting there. But the problem is, at the moment, there isn't even acceptance from some people in the political class that we need to get there. And so there's kind of two calls for Minister Keane. Well, let's have the big debate about what to do and what the best way of doing it is. And, you know, he's got a capitalist approach, and some other political party might have a more central planning approach. Let's have that debate. That's a good one. But at the moment, it's being held back, that genuine debate, by some very loud, noisy voices here and around the world that aren't even accepting the premise that we need to get there.
Yeah, it's an interesting state of affairs, and I think an important conversation to be had across political divides about how we can progress forward. We will need to wrap it up there. Thank you to everyone who was able to join us today. Thank you to Ben O'Quist and Richie Merzian, and also to Matt Keane, New South Wales Minister for Energy and Environment, for being with us today. I also wanted to thank all of the attendees who were able to come along and sign up today to listen. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to all of your questions, the pre-submitted and live questions today. There's just not enough time, but we do really appreciate your input and your attendance at these webinars.
This has been a special summer episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel. All our research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Matt Keane is at Matt_KeaneMP. Ben O'Quist is at Ben O'Quist. Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian, and Noah Schultz-Bayard is at Noah_S. Bayard. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And remember, stay safe this summer, and thanks for listening.